fashionable, the dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Natures, like Gloucester's, cannot be saved by mediating them into an idea of society. Ethics really only makes a fool of them, just as it would be a mockery of Sarah if it were to say to her, "Why do you not express the universal and get married?" Such natures are thoroughly in the paradox, and they are by no means less perfect than other human beings, only either lost in the demonic paradox or saved in the divine paradox. Now, time in and time out, people have been pleased to think that witches, goblins, trolls, etc., are freaks of nature, and it is undeniable that every person has a tendency when he sees a deformed person immediately to associate that impression with moral depravity. What an enormous injustice, inasmuch as the relation ought rather to be reversed. Existence itself has perverted them, just as a stepmother makes the children perverse. The fact of originally being placed outside the universal by nature or historical circumstance is the beginning of the demonic, for which the individual, however, is not personally to blame. Thus, Cumberland's Jew is also a demoniac, even though he does the good. Thus, too, the demonic can express itself as contempt for human beings, yet a contempt, mind you, that does not make the demoniac himself act contemptuously. On the contrary, his forte is in knowing that he is better than all who judge him. Concerning all such matters, the poets should be first, if anything, to sound the alarm. God knows what books the younger would-be poets now living read. Their study probably consists in learning rhymes by heart. God knows what their significance is in existence. At this moment, I do not know if they have any use other than to furnish an edifying proof of the immortality of the soul, inasmuch as one can cheerfully say to oneself about them what Baggerson says about the town's poet, Kildevalle: "If he is immortal, then so are we all." What is said here with reference to Sarah, almost like poetry and thus with an imaginary basis, acquires its full significance if, with a psychological interest, one were to probe the meaning of the old saying, "No great genius has ever existed without a touch of madness." For this dementia is the genius's suffering in existence. It is the expression for, if I dare say so, the divine envy, while genius is the expression for the divine partiality. Thus, from the beginning, the genius is disoriented in relation to the universal and brought into relation to the paradox, whether in despair over his limitations, which in his eyes transform his omnipotence into impotence. He seeks a demonic reassurance, and therefore will not admit it either before God or mortals, or whether he reassures himself religiously in love for the divine. Here lie psychological topics, to which it seems to me one could gladly devote a whole life, and yet we so seldom hear a word about them. In what relation does madness stand to genius? Can the one be constructed out of the other? In what sense and to what extent is the genius master of his madness? For it goes without saying that he is master of it to a certain degree, since otherwise he would indeed really be mad. However, such observations require a high degree of ingenuity and love, for to observe the brilliant is exceedingly difficult. If one were to peruse a few authors of the greatest genius with attentiveness to this, it would perhaps be possible just once, though only with much difficulty, to discover a little. Another incident comes to mind of an individual wanting to save the universal by his concealment and silence. For this, I can use the legend of Faust. Faust is a doubter, an apostate of the spirit, who goes the way of the flesh. This is the purport of the poets, and while it is repeated again and again that every age has its Faust, one poet after the other, nevertheless, goes undaunted down the beaten path. Let us make a small change. Faust is the doubter par excellence, but he has a sympathetic nature. Even in Goethe's interpretation of Faust, I miss a deeper psychological insight into doubt's secret conversations with itself. In our age, when indeed everyone has experienced doubt, No poet as yet has made any step in that direction. I even think, then, that I could readily offer them royal bonds to write on in order to jot down all the large quantity they have experienced in this regard. They would scarcely write more than what could be accommodated on the front margin. Only when one inflects Faust into himself in this way, only then can doubt make a poetic appearance. Only then does he himself also really discover in actuality all its sufferings. He knows then that it is spirit which sustains existence, but he also knows that the security and joy in which people live are not grounded in the power of spirit, but are easily explicable as an unreflective happiness. As doubter, as the doubter, Faust is higher than all this, and if someone wants to deceive him by making him believe one has experienced doubt, then he easily sees through it. For whoever has made a movement in the world of spirit, consequently an infinite movement, can immediately learn through the response whether it is a tried and tested man who is speaking, or a Münchhausen. What a Tamerlane is able to do with his Huns, Faust knows how to do with his doubt. To frighten people into being terror-stricken, to make the ground seem to give way under their feet, to scatter people, to cause a cry of alarm to sound everywhere. And if he does that, then he is, after all, no Tamerlane. He is, in a certain sense, warranted, and has the authorization of thought. But Faust has a sympathetic nature. He loves life. His soul knows no envy. He perceives that he cannot stop the fury he no doubt can provoke. He desires no herostratic honour. He keeps silent. He conceals the doubt more carefully in his soul than the girl who conceals the fruit of a sinful love beneath her heart. He tries as much as possible to walk in step with other people, but what goes on inside him is consumed internally, and, in this way, he makes himself a sacrifice to the universal. When an eccentric pate churns up a whirlwind of doubt, one can sometimes hear people complain, if only he had kept silent. Faust realizes this idea. Whoever has a conception of what it means to say that a person lives by spirit also knows what the hunger of doubt means, and that the doubter hungers just as much for the daily bread of life as for the nourishment of the spirit. Although all the pain Faust suffers may be a very good argument for it not being pride that has possessed him, I shall still use a small measure of precaution, which is easy for me to devise, for just as Gregory of Rimini was called torturer of infants, because he accepted the damnation of infants, so I could be tempted to call myself torturer of heroes, for I am very inventive when it comes to torturing heroes. Faust sees Margaret, not after having chosen lust, for my Faust does not choose lust at all. He sees Margaret not in the concave mirror of Mephistopheles, but in all her lovable innocence, and since his soul has preserved love for humankind, he can very well fall in love with her. But he is a doubter. His doubt has destroyed actuality for him, for my Faust is so ideal that he does not belong with those scholarly doubters who doubt 1 hour every semester at the lectern, but otherwise can do everything else, which in fact they do without the assistance of spirit or by virtue of spirit. He is a doubter, and the doubter hungers just as much for the daily bread of joy as for spiritual food. Nevertheless, he remains true to his resolve, keeps silent, and does not speak to any person of his doubt, nor to Margaret of his love. It stands to reason that Faust is too ideal a figure to be content with the nonsense that if he spoke he would then bring about a general discussion, or that the whole affair would come off without consequence, or perhaps this, or perhaps that. Here, as any poet will readily see, the comic element in the plot lies dormant by bringing Faust into an ironic relation to those low comedy fools in our age who run after doubt, produce an external argument, for example a doctoral certificate, to prove they really have doubted, or swear that they have doubted everything, or prove it by the fact that on their journey they met a doubter. Those couriers and sprinters in the world of spirit, who in great haste get wind of doubt from one person and faith from another, and now do business in the best manner, according to whether the community wants to have fine sand or gravel. Faust is too ideal a figure to go about in slippers. Whoever lacks an infinite passion is not ideal, and whoever has an infinite passion has long since saved his soul from such nonsense. He keeps silent in order to sacrifice himself, or he speaks with awareness that he will put everything into disorder. If he keeps silent, then ethics condemns him, for it says, "You must acknowledge the universal, and you acknowledge it precisely by speaking, and you dare not pity the universal." This consideration should not be forgotten when one sometimes judges a doubter severely because he speaks. I am not inclined to judge such conduct leniently, but here, as everywhere, it holds true that the movements must be carried out properly. If worst comes to worst, then surely a doubter, even though by speaking he brought all possible misfortune upon the world, would be far preferable to those wretched sweet-tooths who taste everything and want to cure doubt without being acquainted with it, and who then, as a rule, are therefore the proximate cause of wild and ungovernable outbreaks of doubt. If the doubter speaks, then he puts everything into disorder, for even if that does not happen, he only hears of it afterwards, and the outcome cannot help one either in the moment of action or with respect to responsibility. If he keeps silent on his own responsibility, then he may well act magnanimously, but he will add a little temptation to his other pain, for the universal will constantly torment him and say, "You should have spoken. How will you find out for certain that it was not, after all, a hidden pride that prompted your resolve?" However, if the doubter can become the single individual who, as the particular, stands in an absolute relation to the absolute, then he can receive an authorization for his silence. If so, he must turn his doubt into guilt. If so, he is in the paradox. But if so, his doubt is cured, even though he may acquire another doubt. Even the New Testament would acknowledge such a silence. Passages may even be found in the New Testament that commend irony, provided it is used to conceal something better. However, this movement is just as much one of irony as any other movement that has its rationale in subjectivity being higher than actuality. People in our age do not want to know anything about this. On the whole, they do not want to know any more about irony than what has been said by Hegel, who, oddly enough, did not understand much about it and bore a grudge against it, which our age has good reason not to give up, for it should always be on its guard against irony. The Sermon on the Mount says, "When you fast, anoint your head and wash your face, that people will not see you fasting." This passage testifies directly to the fact that subjectivity is incommensurable with actuality, even that it has a right to deceive. If only the people in our age who gad about with loose talk about the idea of community would read the New Testament, they might change their minds. But now, Abraham, how did he act? For I have not forgotten, and the reader will now perhaps be kind enough to remember, that it was to come up against that obstacle that I embarked upon the whole preceding investigation, not so Abraham might become more intelligible by it, but so that the unintelligibility might become more conspicuous. For, as was said before, I cannot understand Abraham. I can only admire him. It was also observed that none of the stages described contained an analogy to Abraham. They were only developed in order that, while being shown within their own spheres, they could indicate, so to speak, the boundary of the unknown region at the point of variation. Insofar as there could be any question of an analogy, it must be the paradox of sin. But this again lies in another sphere, and cannot explain Abraham, and is itself far easier to explain than Abraham. So Abraham did not speak. He did not speak to Sarah, to Eliezer, or to Isaac. He bypassed these three ethical agents, for the ethical had no higher expression than family life for Abraham. Aesthetics allowed, even demanded, silence of the single individual when he knew that by keeping silent he could save another. This already sufficiently shows that Abraham does not lie within the scope of aesthetics. His silence is not at all to save Isaac, as, on the whole, his entire task of sacrificing Isaac for his own sake and for God's sake is an offence to aesthetics, for it can well understand that I sacrifice myself, but not that I sacrifice another for my own sake. The aesthetic hero was silent. Ethics convicted him, however, because he was silent by virtue of his accidental particularity. His human prescience was what determined him to be silent. This ethics cannot forgive. Any human knowledge like that is only an illusion. Ethics demands an infinite movement. It demands disclosure. The aesthetic hero, then, can speak but will not. The genuine, tragic hero sacrifices himself and all that is his for the universal. His deed and every emotion within him belong to the universal. He is open, and in this revelation, the beloved son of ethics. This does not apply to Abraham. He does nothing for the universal and is concealed. Now we are at the paradox. Either the single individual as the particular can be in an absolute relation to the absolute, and then ethics is not the highest, or Abraham is lost. He is neither a tragic hero nor an aesthetic hero. In a way, it may seem here again that the paradox is the easiest and simplest thing of all. However, may I repeat that whoever remains convinced of this is not a knight of faith, for distress and anxiety are the only conceivable justification, even if it is not conceivable in general, for then the paradox is annulled. Abraham keeps silent, but he cannot speak. Therein lies the distress and anxiety. For if I cannot make myself intelligible when I speak, I do not speak even though I go on talking incessantly day and night. This is Abraham's situation. He can say everything, but one thing he cannot say, and yet if he cannot say it, that is, say it in such a way that another person understands it, he does not speak. The relief in speaking is that it translates me into the universal. Now Abraham can say the most beautiful words any language can procure about how he loves Isaac. But this is not what at heart he has in mind to say. It is something deeper, that he is willing to sacrifice Isaac because it is a trial. No one can understand the latter, and thus everyone can only misunderstand the former. The tragic hero is unacquainted with this distress. First of all, he has the consolation that every counter-argument has had its deserts, that he has been able to give Clytemnestra, Iphigenia, Achilles, the chorus, every living being, every voice from the heart of humankind, every clever, every alarming, every accusing, every sympathetic thought, an opportunity to stand up against him. He can be sure that everything which possibly can be said against him has been said ruthlessly, mercilessly, and to struggle against the whole world is a comfort. To struggle with oneself is frightful. He ought not to be afraid of having overlooked anything, so that one day afterwards he perhaps must cry out, as King Edward IV did at the news of the murder of Clarence. "Who sued to me for him? Who, in my wrath, kneeled at my feet and bade me be advised? Who spoke of brotherhood? Who spoke of love?" The tragic hero is unacquainted with the frightful responsibility of solitude. Moreover, he has the consolation that he can weep and wail with Clytemnestra and Iphigenia, and tears and cries are soothing, but unutterable sighs are torturing. Agamemnon can quickly collect his soul in the certainty that he will act, and then he still has time to console and encourage. This Abraham cannot do. When his heart is stirred, when his words would contain a blessed consolation for the whole world, he dares not console. For would not Sarah, would not Eliezer, would not Isaac say to him, "Why do you want to do this, then? After all, you can let it be." And if then, in his distress, he wanted to unburden himself and embrace all who were dear to him before proceeding to the finish, he would perhaps bring about the frightful consequence that Sarah, Eliezer, and Isaac would be offended at him and think he was a hypocrite. Speak he cannot. He speaks no human language. Even if he understood all the languages of the world, even if those loved ones also understood them, he still cannot speak. He speaks in a divine language. He speaks in tongues. This distress I can well understand. I can admire Abraham. I have no fear that anyone would be tempted by this story frivolously to want to be the single individual. But I also confess that I do not have courage for it, and that I would gladly renounce any prospect of going further, if only it were possible for me to ever come that far, be it ever so late. At any moment Abraham can stop. He can repent the whole thing as a temptation. Then he can speak. Then everybody can understand him. But then he is no longer Abraham. Abraham cannot speak, for he cannot say that which would explain everything, i.e. so it is intelligible, that it is a trial, of a sort, mind you, in which the ethical is the temptation. Anyone so situated is an emigrant from the sphere of the universal. But even less can he say the next thing. For, as was sufficiently elaborated earlier, Abraham makes two movements. He makes the infinite movement of resignation and gives up Isaac. This no one can understand because it is a private undertaking. But next, at every moment, he makes the movement of faith. This is his consolation. He says, to wit, "Surely it will not happen, or if it does, the Lord will give me a new Isaac, namely by virtue of the absurd." The tragic hero, however, gets to the end of the story. Iphigenia yields to her father's resolve. She herself makes the infinite movement of resignation, and they now have a mutual understanding. She can understand Agamemnon because his undertaking expresses the universal. On the contrary, if Agamemnon were to say to her, "Although the god demands you as a sacrifice, it is still possible that he did not demand it, that is, by virtue of the absurd," then he would at the same moment become unintelligible to Iphigenia. If he could say this by virtue of human reckoning, then Iphigenia no doubt would understand him, but then it would follow that Agamemnon had not made the infinite movement of resignation, and thus would be no hero. Then the soothsayer's pronouncement is a sea captain's yarn, and the whole incident is a vaudeville. Abraham, then, did not speak. Only one word from him has been preserved, the single reply to Isaac, which also sufficiently shows that he had not spoken previously. Isaac asks Abraham where the lamb is for the burnt offering. "And Abraham said, 'God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son.'" This last word of Abraham I shall consider here in a little more detail. Without this word, the whole incident would lack something. If it had been different, then everything would perhaps dissolve into confusion. I have often considered to what extent a tragic hero, whether culminating in a suffering or an action, should have a final remark. In my opinion, it depends on what sphere of life he belongs to, whether his life has intellectual significance, whether his suffering or action is related to spirit. It goes without saying that the tragic hero, like every other person who is not bereft of speech, can say a few words, perhaps a few appropriate words, at his moment of culmination. But the question is whether it is appropriate for him to say them. If the significance of his life consists in an external deed, then he has nothing to say. Then everything he says is essentially chit-chat, by which he only weakens the impression he makes. Whereas the etiquette of tragedy enjoins him to accomplish his task silently, whether it consists in an action or in a suffering. In order not to go too far afield, I shall just take what lies closest at hand. If Agamemnon himself, not Calchas, were to have drawn the knife against Iphigenia, then he would only have demeaned himself by wanting to say a few words at the last moment, for the significance of his deed was certainly obvious to everybody. The process of piety, sympathy, feeling, and tears was complete, and his life had no relation to spirit otherwise, that is, he was not a teacher or a witness of the spirit. On the contrary, if the significance of a hero's life is oriented towards spirit, then the lack of a remark would weaken the impression he makes. What he then has to say is not a few appropriate words, a little piece of oratory, but the import of his remark is that he consummates himself at the decisive moment. An intellectual, tragic hero like that should have and retain the last word. He is required to have the same transfigured bearing that becomes every tragic hero, but one word is still required. If an intellectual, tragic hero like that culminates in a suffering, in death, then he becomes immortal through this last word before he dies, whereas the ordinary, tragic hero, on the contrary, only becomes immortal after his death. Socrates can be used as an example. He was an intellectual, tragic hero. His death sentence is announced to him. At that moment, he dies. For anyone who does not understand that the whole strength of spirit is required for dying, and that the hero always dies before he dies, will not get very far in his observation of life. As a hero, Socrates is now required to be in a tranquil state of equilibrium, but as an intellectual, tragic hero, he is required to have enough spiritual strength at the final moment to fulfill himself. He cannot concentrate then on standing his ground over against death like the ordinary tragic hero, but must make this movement so quickly that at the same moment he is consciously past this struggle and holds his own. Thus, if Socrates had been silent in the crisis of death, he would then have weakened the effect of his life and aroused a suspicion that the elasticity of irony in him was not a world power but a game, the flexibility of which must be used according to an inverted scale to sustain him pathetically at the decisive moment. What is briefly suggested here is certainly not applicable to Abraham if one thinks by some analogy to be able to find an appropriate final word for Abraham. But it certainly does apply, provided one perceives the necessity of Abraham having to fulfill himself at the final moment, not by silently drawing the knife, but by having a word to say, since as the father of faith he has absolute significance with respect to spirit. As to what he is to say, I can form no conception in advance. After he has said it, I presumably can understand it, presumably in a certain sense can understand Abraham in what was said, yet without thereby coming any closer to him than I have previously. If no final remark by Socrates had existed, then I could have imagined myself in his place and fashioned one, and had I not been able to do it, a poet would have known how. But no poet is equal to Abraham. Before going on to consider Abraham's final word more closely, I must first point out the difficulty of Abraham coming to say anything at all. As elaborated above, the distress and anxiety in the paradox are due precisely to the silence. Abraham cannot speak. In a way, then, it is a self-contradiction to demand that he should speak, unless one would have him outside the paradox again, so that at the decisive moment he suspends it, whereby he then ceases to be Abraham and annuls all that preceded. Thus, if Abraham now at the decisive moment were to say to Isaac, "It is you to whom it applies," this would only be a weakness. For if he could speak at all, then he ought to have spoken long before, and the weakness would then consist in the fact that he had not had the spiritual maturity and concentration to imagine all of the pain beforehand, but had shoved some aside in such a way that the actual pain was more than the imagined one. Moreover, he would fall out of the paradox by such talk, and if he really wanted to speak to Isaac, he must transform his situation into a temptation, for otherwise he could surely say nothing, and if he does that, then he is not even a tragic hero. However, a final word by Abraham has in fact been preserved. And insofar as I can understand the paradox, I can also understand Abraham's total presence in that word. First and foremost, he does not say anything, and in this form he says what he has to say. His reply to Isaac has the form of irony, for it is always irony when I say something and yet do not say anything. Isaac asks Abraham in the supposition that Abraham knows. Now if Abraham had replied, "I know nothing," he would have uttered an untruth. He cannot say anything, for what he knows he cannot say. He replies then, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." From this one sees the double movement in Abraham's soul as previously described. If Abraham had merely resigned Isaac and done no more, then he would have uttered an untruth, for he indeed knows that God demands Isaac for a sacrifice, and he knows that he himself, precisely at this moment, is ready to sacrifice him. After having made this movement, he has, at every moment, made the next one, has made the movement of faith by the virtue of the absurd. In principle, he utters no untruth, for by virtue of the absurd, it is indeed possible that God could do something entirely different. He utters no untruth, then, but neither does he say anything, for he speaks in a foreign tongue. This becomes even more evident when we consider that it was Abraham himself who must sacrifice Isaac. Had the task been different, had the Lord commanded Abraham to bring Isaac up on Mount Moriah so he himself could let his lightning strike Isaac and take him as a sacrifice in that way, then in a literal sense, Abraham would have been right in speaking as enigmatically as he does, for then he himself would not have known what would happen. But given the way the task is placed on Abraham, he himself indeed must act. So, at the decisive moment, he must know what he himself will do, and consequently, he must know that Isaac is to be sacrificed. If he has not known this for certain, then he has not made the infinite movement of resignation. Then his words are certainly not untrue, but he is still very far from being Abraham. He is more insignificant than a tragic hero. Indeed, he is an irresolute man who cannot make up his mind one way or the other, and for that reason always speaks in riddles. But a vacillator like that is just a parody of the knight of faith. Here again, then, it appears that one may well understand Abraham, but only in the way one understands the paradox. For my part, I can perhaps understand Abraham, but realize as well that I do not have the courage to speak in this way, no more than I have courage to act like Abraham. But by no means do I therefore say that it is something insignificant, when on the contrary, it is the only miracle. And now, what did the contemporary age think of the tragic hero? That he was great, and it admired him. And that honourable assembly of nobles, the jury, which every generation establishes to judge the previous generation, it judged likewise. But there was no one who could understand Abraham. And yet, what did he achieve? He remained true to his love. But whoever loves God needs no tears, no admiration. He forgets the suffering in the love. Indeed, so completely has he forgotten it, that there would not be the slightest trace of his pain afterwards if God himself did not remember it. For he sees in secret, and knows the distress, and counts the tears, and forgets nothing. Either there is then a paradox that the single individual as the particular stands in an absolute relation to the absolute, or Abraham is lost. Epilogue. On one occasion when the price of spices in Holland became somewhat slack, the merchants let a few loads be dumped at sea in order to drive up the price. This was a pardonable, perhaps a necessary, stratagem. Do we need something similar in the world of spirit? Are we so sure of having attained the highest that there is nothing left to do except piously to delude ourselves that we have not come so far in order still to have something with which to fill the time? Does the present generation need such a self-deception? Should a virtuosity in this be cultivated in it, or is it not rather sufficiently perfected in the art of self-deception? Or is what it needs not rather an honest earnestness that fearlessly and incorruptibly calls attention to the tasks, an honest earnestness that lovingly preserves the tasks, that does not make people anxiously want to rush precipitously to the highest, but keeps the tasks young, beautiful, delightful to look upon, and inviting to all, yet also difficult and inspiring for the noble-minded? For the noble nature is inspired only by the difficult. Whatever one generation learns from another, no generation learns the genuinely human from a previous one. In this respect, every generation begins primitively, has no other task than each previous generation, and advances no further, provided the previous generation has not betrayed the task and deceived itself. This genuinely human quality is passion, in which the one generation perfectly understands the other and understands itself as well. Thus, no generation has learned how to love from another. No generation gets to begin at any other point than at the beginning. No later generation has a shorter task than the previous one. And if someone here is unwilling to abide with love like those previous generations, but wants to go further, then that is only foolish and idle talk. But the highest passion in a human being is faith. And here no generation begins at any other point than the previous one. Every generation begins from the beginning, and the following generation goes no further than the previous one, provided the latter remained true to its task and did not leave it in the lurch. That this must be tiring is naturally something the generation cannot say, for the generation, after all, has the task and nothing to do with the fact that the previous generation had the same task, unless the particular generation or the individuals in it presumptuously wants to occupy the place that belongs only to the spirit who governs the world and has the patience not to become tired. If the generation begins that sort of thing, it is perverse. And what wonder, then, that the whole of existence seems perverse to it? For there is surely no one who has found existence to be more perverse than the tailor, who, according to the fairy tale, went up to heaven during his lifetime and viewed the world from that standpoint. As long as the generation is concerned only with its task, which is the highest, then it cannot become tired, for the task is always sufficient for a lifetime. When the children on a holiday have already finished playing all the games before noon, and now impatiently say, "Is there no one who can think of a new game?" Does this show, then, that these children are more developed and precocious than the children in the same or a previous generation who could make the familiar games last for the whole day? Or does it not rather show that these first children lack what I would call the endearing earnestness that belongs to play? Faith is the highest passion in a human being. There are perhaps many in every generation who do not even come to it, but nobody goes further. Whether there are also many in our age who do not discover it, I do not decide. I dare only refer to myself, who does not conceal that it may not happen for a long time to come for him, yet without his therefore wishing to deceive himself or the great by making it into a trifling matter, into a childhood malady one must wish to get over as soon as possible. But life has tasks enough also for the one who does not one day come to faith, and if he honestly loves them, then his life will not be wasted, even if it never becomes like those who were sensible of and grasped the highest. But the one who has come to faith, whether he is extraordinarily gifted or simple-minded does not matter, does not come to a standstill in faith. Indeed, he would be shocked if someone said this to him, just as the lover would feel indignant if one said he had come to a standstill in love, for he would answer, "I am not standing still at all, since I have my life in it." Yet he gets no further, nor to something else, for if he discovers the latter, then he has another explanation. One must go further. One must go further. This urge to go further is ancient in the world. Heraclitus the Obscure, who deposited his thoughts in writings, and his writings in the Temple of Diana, for his thoughts had been his armour in life, and therefore he hung it in the temple of the goddess. Heraclitus the Obscure has said, "One cannot pass through the same river twice." Heraclitus the Obscure had a disciple who did not stop there. He went further and added, "One cannot do it even once." Poor Heraclitus, to have such a disciple! By this improvement, the Heraclitian thesis was amended to an Eleatic thesis that denies motion. And yet, that disciple only wanted to be a disciple of Heraclitus who went further, not back, to what Heraclitus had abandoned.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.